and welcome to this week's Convex Conversation with me, journalist Helen Fospero. In his teens, today's guest was on course to become a professional tennis player, but at 19 he realised he wouldn't realise his goal to be in the world's top 10, so he switched to coaching. Toby Foxcroft was involved in training some of the sport's finest players, working alongside one of the most highly respected coaches, Nick Bollettieri, and he was president and on the board of the exclusive Queen's Club in London. He spent the last two decades using the skills he learned in elite sport, helping blue chip companies unlock the creative energy of their staff, deliver culture change, and improve performance, as well as helping individuals find who they are. And his latest project is a bold initiative to repurpose a decommissioned US naval vessel for humanitarian support and to help with disaster relief efforts. So, Toby, it's fantastic to have you with us today. How the devil are you?
Hi, Helen. That was so eloquently put. What an introduction.
Did you think it was you, or do you think I was just making it up?
Well, it was definitely me, but I wish I could have you introducing me every time.
I want to start right up to date with the Coalition of Hope. 40,000 tons of hope, to be precise. I didn't know anything about this, Toby, until we chatted on a little walk in the park the other day. So tell us all about it.
It's the brainchild of a former military man in the US called Tim Keegan, who's an exceptional human being. And it's his vision to use two aircraft carriers, US military aircraft carriers, which are being decommissioned. And if we weren't doing something fantastic with them, they'd basically be given to scrap. And his idea was to decommission the aircraft carriers, remove fixed wing capabilities, and start to look at how we might put drones and e-helicopters on there. And when I talk about drones, I talk about drones where you can put five or six people on the machines.
But no pilot.
Nope, you don't even need pilots, no. And if you bear in mind, an aircraft carrier is approximately 5 acres of land. The idea is to use this as these vehicles to go to places that are in crisis. For instance, a tsunami, where if there's a crisis in the world like that, what normally happens is particularly UK and US naval operations move from their primary goal to going to help with the humanitarian aid. That brings a number of problems. One, it removes them from their primary goal. But two, they go under their flag, the British flag and the American flag. And you know, it goes without saying that brings all sorts of ramifications, even though they're there to help. So the idea is to decommission these two aircraft carriers, which is presently going to Congress, where we'll put incredible technology, we'll have areas of sustainability, green issues, water, sea, marine biology, COVID, Ebola, you name it. Expertise will be on these ships. And we can go to these places in crisis and go and help, but under the flag of the country in crisis. So that's the sort of the highlight of the vision. Of course, there's so much else because there'll be lots of science and development and workings going on where, well, you just never know what's going to happen. But just through being there, you can go and make an enormous difference. You can bring two animals onto one, two by two. You can bring in, you know, thousands of refugees where you can at least give them water. One of the major problems with these countries that are natural disasters, there's no water. There was no clean water, at least. So even if it's just that for a couple of weeks, it buys time other than having exactly the right people on these vessels to go and help and make a difference.
It's funny, isn't it? You talk about the basic needs that people need in a disaster, you know, clean water and food, and yet you will be at the forefront of technology using cutting edge technology. E-helicopters, I've never even heard of e-helicopters. Do they exist yet, Toby?
They do, and the development is gaining pace. But if you can imagine that we have the US military helping us develop these machines. So we've got the best of science, the best of technology to make this thing work.
And where do you fit into the project?
I am chairing the international committee, and I was very fortunate to have met Tim and started talking with him about people we know and things that we'd like to get involved in and having a purpose, even just in terms of having an individual purpose, a personal purpose of being here on Earth and life and how you can make it more colorful and how you can feel that you're being useful. And in talking to Tim, I just was so interested and desperately wanted to get involved in the project. He and I got on very well, and I happen to have a great pal. I probably shouldn't regard him as a pal, but we are great friends, and he's an extraordinary man called Field Marshal, the Lord Charles Guthrie, who was head of our armed services and SAS. Incredible man. And of course, Tim was very interested in him, and I spoke to Charles about it. And he said, do you know what? I've had this vision in the UK for a long, long time, because they just put these aircraft carriers into scrap, but nobody will do it. Nobody has the vision. Nobody has the, even when you have the vision to do it, in this country, nobody really stands up and says, yes, let's do something different with these. And of course, America is entirely different. They're willing to take risk in a much different way. And so I was able to get Charles involved. And you'll see that all the dignitaries and the names and the military people who are involved there, you'll see Charles as one of the stalwarts and head of that.
It sounds an extraordinary project. And honestly, if there's anything I can do, do shout out. It just sounds absolutely amazing and so needed.
Well, let's hope that it happens. I mean, I'm pretty sure it will. And Tim is an extraordinary man. I'd love you to meet him at some point. And I've no doubt that you'd be able to help and bring a lot to that party if that was of interest to you. And of course, I know you get actively involved in huge amounts of work and initiatives that you actually drive and make happen. I've read a lot of what you've been doing, and of course we've talked a little bit. You're enormously impressive in the way you get on and do things.
I'm blushing now, but like it is to you, it's really important to me to try and make a difference. And I think if we all try and make a small difference, it's the butterfly effect, isn't it? The ripple effect. You know, you can make a big difference.
Yes, a lot of people can make a little, you know, if we can just make a little bit of difference. And, but this is it's an amazing project, isn't it? How many people can be lucky enough to say that they're even involved in the startup of this type of thing? The other thing it does, of course, is it helps you as an individual just gain confidence in yourself. I mean, listen, I'm nearly 60 years old, and you go along in life, and I'm sure you're well aware of it, that if you're in any way introspective, you go around your life going up and down from having great confidence to having sometimes no confidence in yourself at all. And when other people who you feel have done the most incredible things, and you look at them and go, I've met so many people in my life, and you are one of the most incredible ones, Tim, and they want you involved, it's an amazing feeling.
And you're doing really for yourself there what you do for individuals. We're going to talk about the things you do in companies later, culture and leadership. But you do help a lot of individuals, as I said in the introduction, find themselves and find what they're good at and have a purpose, don't you?
Yes, it's an enormous privilege to be able to do that. I was thinking a little bit about it before we came on to talk, and I sort of considered in my chat with myself about it, is that actually in order to get to where you are, you have to have a background and you have to have started somewhere, as we all do with parents. And it's worth knowing where one comes from, because if you listen to me and you listen to me talk, of course, I'm fairly eloquent. I've got quite a nice voice and I speak reasonably well. And therefore, yes, I can become chairman of the Queen's Club, which is essentially run by old Etonians. And you would be forgiven, therefore, if you read that little part of me, that thinking that I might be at least public school, if not an old Etonian, of which I am absolutely neither.
You're a Yorkshireman, aren't you?
I am a Yorkshireman. Yes, I am. I'm very proud of it. But I've never lived in Yorkshire. My parents were from Roundhay. My father was the youngest of six to a father who fought in Ypres and the Somme, 17 years old, alongside his 16-year-old brother, who was shot in the head on the very first day of battle.
Oh, dear.
My grandfather was there for a long time, and he survived possibly because he got shot in the shoulder and then returned to England late on in the war. So he'd been there for a long time. And then you look at that, just that very nature of coming back to England and living in Leeds, you're going to have six children. And my father being the youngest, so therefore was mostly brought up by his sisters, because his parents were quite old by that time. And what reference that has on his life, on his confidence, on all sorts of things and how he was brought up. And then he marries my mother, who happened to have been an illegitimate child and was brought up by her grandparents. Now, can you imagine that in the 30s? It is extraordinary because it was frowned upon. And my mother was brought up by her grandparents, her grandfather. She thought they were her parents, by the way. Her father, grandfather, died when she was 15. And her mother decided that they probably couldn't afford to keep her at music school, where she had become already a concert pianist. From there, my mother went to work at the BBC illegally, BBC Leeds, working with Barney Colohan, who famously produced The Good Old Days and It's a Knockout, Je suis frontière.
Of course, I don't remember those. Just joking, I do. They were good.
It was just wonderful. And incidentally, I was also taken to Leeds United quite a few times in their heyday. Ah. So they were my team. And then you bring those two people together. And whether they have a good marriage or a bad marriage or however those things go, and then they have two sons, one of which I'm the eldest, and you make your way. So I was brought up, actually, I was born in Leeds because my parents moved down to Buckinghamshire, a little village called Wendover, which was all countryside at the time. It's changed, of course. And before I was born, my mother was sent up back up to Leeds so I could be born a Yorkshireman in order to play cricket for Yorkshire.
And you didn't play cricket for Yorkshire.
Unless you were born in Yorkshire, you couldn't play for Yorkshire.
You had your sights on football, didn't you, in those days, or as a teenager?
Oh, in my teenage years, all I was interested in playing football. I went to the local state school where you probably couldn't get thrown out unless you did something absolutely dreadful. I mean, it was lovely. I enjoyed school, but I learned absolutely nothing. In fact, I thought that I was thick when I was at school. In those days, they used to have chemistry, physics, and biology, and human biology. And you would do those four, unless you were really thick, in which case you went to do Nuffield science, which was a little bit about everything, but probably not very much. I just managed to stay in class on two of those rather than going to the Nuffield group. But, you know, nevertheless, I mean, I was very aware that I wasn't very clever at school.
But you were sporting, though, weren't you?
I was very sporty. So I threw myself into football. The school I went to, funny enough, didn't play football. So I became a bit of a maverick and a little bit of trouble in that way, although I was a nice kid. I was always fighting after school. And I don't think they quite knew what to do with me. I wasn't a ruffian. It was all about fairness and helping people in those days. And it looked like I was going to become a professional footballer, whatever that would mean, good or bad, money or no money, probably no money in those days. And my mother decided that, actually, no, you're not going to. The family are going to learn to play tennis. So at 15, I started to play tennis or learn to play tennis with the rest of the family. So happy family fours was the idea.
It went further than that, though, didn't it?
Far too competitive. By 17, I was trying to play county tennis. That wasn't on the cards. It was very difficult for my parents to get me involved in tennis because in those, even at the local village tennis club, I couldn't get in because you didn't know the right people.
Gosh, that's interesting, isn't it? No, I can fully understand that.
And therefore, there was a pecking order within the county, and therefore, I couldn't get into that either. I was a reasonable player for having played for 2 years, but I worked very hard and I had a great coach, had a couple of summer group lessons and a few private lessons from him. And I just learned the game. But psychologically, of course, you're very immature with tennis. Tennis is a game you really have to learn. Technically, it's tough to learn, but also psychologically, it's tough to learn. And if you're not in it for long enough, it's terribly difficult to make it. But I decided that I was going to head towards the United States at 19. Because the best player in the UK at the time was a guy called Jeremy Bates. He was probably ranked somewhere around the 100. And so he's the hierarchy of British tennis. So how's somebody like me going to go to the hierarchy of British tennis? You're not. So you can't test yourself. So I thought, well, the States has got McEnroe, Connors, great players in the top 20 in the world. Why don't I go there? And I think I'll find a little bit out. So I announced that I was going to go to New York City. And my parents said, oh, are you darling, type of thing, and knowing I couldn't afford to. I used to take my friends to the pub in the evening. I drive, I didn't drink, of course, but I overheard a conversation about a chap who was buying antique clocks in the UK and selling them in the US. So out of my pocket money and my coaching money, I bought antique clocks and took them to the States, and I sold them for a lot of money. And so in those days, I had about just under $50,000 in my pocket. This is in 1980.
That's a lot of money in 1980.
Which saw me around the circuit for a while. That was eye-opening.
Was it? In what way?
Well, I played 2 months of tennis and lost every single match I played in every tournament. First round, finished, out. I then got down to Florida And I played a tournament at a country club down in Sarasota. And after I'd played, I made it through a couple of rounds. And the coach there, the head pro, said to me, "Would you like to come and live here? We will give you your food. We'll give you your board. If you could just play with our members whenever they didn't have anybody to play against." Of course, they love the English. Americans loved the English at that time, and I was a nice kid, so why wouldn't they do that? And of course, it was wonderful for me because I got to just play tennis all day long. And one day, a guy called Bob Blazkowicz turned up at this country club, and Blazkowicz was looking for somebody to play against. They said, "Well, you know, there's this English guy," and so on court I went with him, not realizing at the time this guy was ranked 50 in the world. He was the only guy to beat Lendl that year. And he and I trained for 6 hours a day. The first week, I mean, he was just beating me no end. But of course, I learned so much. You do. You're somebody who's much better than you, you pick it up much quicker. So I learned a lot and I started winning a few tournaments, but nothing of any note. But what I realized is that Blazkowicz was living in a camper van. He had nobody to play against. He was ranked 50 in the world. Nobody had ever heard of him. And it sort of rang a few bells. And when eventually I managed to get myself in front of a guy called Harry Hopman, who was probably the greatest coach on the planet at the time, coaching the great Australians of Rosewall, Roach, Newcombe, Laver, a whole dearth of wonderful players. He said to me, "You've got everything. You're athletic. You've got great ball sense. You're fast. You're aggressive. You've got all those things except one thing to make it into the top 10. You don't want to kill anybody. You don't want to destroy anybody." And of course, I said, "Well, no, why would you ever want to destroy anybody?" And he meant mentally, of course. I understood that. There was his answer. It was always going to be, I was never going to be a great tennis player, but I was going to be a good one. But he said to me, "Go and be a coach. You're a nurturer. You're totally the opposite. You're not a destroyer of people. You're a nurturer." He knew tennis. Go and be a tennis coach.
And you went off to be a tennis coach, and you, I know you're really modest and you're very humble about it, but you have coached some of the finest players in the world, haven't you?
I've been lucky enough to do that, to be on court with them and working with them on improving their games, yes. And I'm very thankful to the greatest coach in the world called Nick Bollettieri. I worked for him for many, many years. He gave me the most incredible opportunities. He is a most extraordinary man, incredible character. And so, yes, he produced 10 world number ones. And everybody looks at those 10 world number ones. We know who they are. And I was lucky enough to be able to get on court with them. And Nick would say, you know, "Do this, do that." And I'd work with them on their game. But also what Nick did was build an academy that had over 100 tennis courts. And what he also did was give people scholarships to go and learn to play tennis. He also put hundreds and probably actually no, it's thousands of children. I'm not exaggerating. Thousands of children into US universities. Tennis was a gateway to other things, even if you didn't come in to be, you know, making money. You had to be top 50 in order to make money. So how many of the kids were going to do that? Not very many, but a lot would go to college. It gave them that gateway into college, into American colleges. So he did much, much more than just produce 10 world number ones, although that's pretty amazing.
And just because you said we'd know who, give us an idea of the era. So what sort of characters was he looking after that were in the top 10 in those days?
Famously, Agassi, Courier, Wheaton, Mary Pierce, Monica Seles. Then later on, of course, it was the Williams sisters. It was Sharapova and a whole host of others. It's fascinating working with these people. You don't know this until you do work with them. They have exactly the same sensitivities as we have. I don't want to go and play today. I'm not sure I'm good enough. They have all these things. And so just as anyone else does, they need help. And if you've got the right people behind you and the right people working with you, then you're the right individual, then you've got a great chance. But it isn't just about being hugely talented. There are a lot of talented derelicts, right?
That's right.
So yes. And the other thing that one notes from the conversation I had with Harry Hopman and his observations of me was that when you do meet these guys who become number one in the world, number one, two, number three, they are absolute killers, unbelievable destroyers. They relish destroying people, particularly the top singles players. Quite incredibly tough.
If you were writing your memoirs, you must have so many stories that you could include, but share with us a story from that period that really sticks out for you or you have very fond memories of.
Oh, well, I have got lots. I suppose as a coach, you're wanting to learn all the time. You're like a sponge. And so to watch Nick Bollettieri working with his players, I'm going to learn huge amounts from that. So I would sit and just listen to him and watch. It was fascinating. And of course, I'm slightly dyslexic. And so the classroom, in terms of do this, do that, do the other, doesn't really work for me. But if I go and observe and I watch, and then of course you can copy. You copy what they do, you learn what they do. And when you go and do it yourself, you bring a certain uniqueness because it's you doing it, although you're trying to copy them. And so that in itself, just watching him work, you could watch him for 8 hours and you'd never get bored. Absolutely fascinating. He tells a great story with Agassi, and Agassi is clearly going to be an amazing tennis player. And he goes to play in his first tournament and he loses his match and he's absolutely furious. He breaks all his rackets. And later on, when he's calmed down, he says, "Andre, do you see me wearing a watch?" And Andre looks at his wrists and sees that Nick Bollettieri isn't wearing a watch. And he says, "No, Nick, you're not wearing a watch. No." He said, "Do you know why?" "I won't attempt to do the American accent." And Andre looked at him and said, "No, I don't know why." He said, "Because I'm not timing your success." Now, the ordinary coach would go, "Why are you so angry? Why do you smash your rackets? You say you're going to give up on the game and everything. Don't be so ridiculous." No. And that doesn't work. Bollettieri understood people very well. Great intuition. And by the way, Bollettieri couldn't play tennis.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it?
He learned how to coach tennis. He was married 8 times. But his first wife, he used to send her to watch the local tennis coach in Miami and come back with the information of what he's doing.
That's extraordinary. I mean, he is an absolute legend. And I didn't know that he didn't play tennis himself. So how did working with elite athletes lead you to the work that you've been doing for the last 20 years, helping businesses? There are a lot of similarities, aren't there, I would imagine?
There are lots of similarities. When I got an opportunity, because Bollettieri was owned by International Management Group, Mark McCormack was the biggest private company in the world at the time. If lots of your listeners will have watched a movie with Tom Cruise in it, it was about a sports agent called Jerry Maguire.
Yeah, I remember that.
Mark McCormack was the very first Jerry Maguire. He was the first sports agent. And he said to his golfers, "And you know, I will make you much more money than you can ever make just hitting a golf ball and winning the tournament and getting the prize money." And of course, he shook their hand. It was never a contract at that time. In fact, I think it was Arnold Palmer. He had a contract with him and it lasted all the way through to when he died. Just the handshake, no written contract at all. And McCormack built this business up. And fortunately, they gave me a wonderful opportunity to go to Germany to set up Bollettieri across Europe. I didn't speak one word of German, but of course I said yes. And I set up the offices in Berlin. And it was in 1990, about 8 months after the wall had come down. And I was busy setting up Bollettieri Tennis Academies across Germany and Belgium, Italy, a number of other places in Europe. And I went east and I was just fascinated by it. And meeting people who'd never been out of East Germany, had never been out of their village, who also meeting ex-SS officers. There was all sorts of interest going on there. Anyway, there was a place called Bad Zarrow on a lake called Scharmützelsee that used to be the German summer playground for all the wealthy before the war. I thought at the time it would be very interesting to relaunch that place with the Bollettieri Tennis Academy. And so that's what I tried to do. I met with Mark McCormack and he said to me, "Tennis doesn't make money," which rather put an end to that idea. But I had a lot of land. And then we met some Austrians who also had land and we brought the land together. And in the end, we built 3 championship golf courses, Langer, Faldo and Arnold Palmer, a Bollettieri Tennis Academy with only a small amount of courts, Schockermuhl Riding Academy and a yachting marina with a Kempinski Hotel.
You don't do anything by halves, do you?
Very lucky to get involved with incredible projects. We cut trees down in these forests. You go in there and all you could hear is woodpeckers. This is in 1990. It was an enormous effort to get this done because there were all sorts of challenges that would usually just put an end to this project. But we managed to do it. I won't go into all the details, interesting though they are. But funny enough, 20 years later, I was taken out to Romania to Carpathia, which is the last remaining wilderness in Europe. There are still wolves, there are still lynx, there are still incredible ancient fauna, trees, a massive expanse. And they asked me if I would like to build a golf course and a hotel there. And you remember Nelson Mandela when he came out of prison, and one of the things he's famous for saying, when you come out, if you don't see things with new eyes, it means you've learned nothing. Hopefully, as you get older, your mind changes, the world moves on, and you look at it in a more mature, rounded way.
So you've had these key moments, haven't you? The moment when you realised that professional tennis wasn't for you and that you would go into coaching. And then this light bulb moment when you saw this wilderness and realised that actually that didn't want to be turned into a golf course, etc. So where did the business side come in? Because you've made such a massive contribution to many global companies in terms of leadership advice and culture change. And I'm fascinated by all of that, partly because the Convex Conversation is for Convex Insurance, and I've rarely seen culture thought of so highly, really, in a company. It's really valued from the CEO down. So tell me about how that work came about and how you used your work with top athletes to bring that into a business environment, if you like, you know, that mindset of a champion.
It's very comforting, incidentally, and very unusual to hear somebody talk about culture as you've just done within any company. Very unusual for companies. Massive mistake for the companies, of course, when they don't, and most don't. I'm very encouraged when you say that. And normally when they are keen on culture, they do it incredibly well because it's a learning process. And it's much about learning as it is about curiosity, because without curiosity, there is no learning. But you look at a lot of the companies in this country and they have no idea what culture means. They think it means a process or a change of process or a change of transaction. It's nothing to do with it. It's all around people behavior and how you treat people in the business and how they come together and build something extraordinary. I was driven into culture change and building a business that is Motivate International really through not knowing what on earth to do. I've always been driven. I've never known what I'm going to do. I can remember sitting in the kitchen of my parents' house, when I left school going, I don't know what I'm going to do with my life. I really don't know. And then something opens up. That's why when I finished in Berlin, I came back and didn't know what I wanted to do. And of course, the natural thing is perhaps to have gone to work for David Lloyd, which I did for about 18 months. And that was very interesting because David Lloyd Leisure, he set up David Lloyd Leisure with all the indoor court. David is an extraordinary guy again. And so you sit on these people's shoulders and you watch them and you sit with them and you talk to them and you learn such a massive amount. You don't become them and you don't become brilliant at what they do, but you learn about them and learn how they've done these things. It's such a privilege to, I suppose, just be next to these people and watch them. And so I did a bit of that. And it was going to be boring because nothing was going to be interesting in tennis after IMG and Bollettieri and Berlin. Many years before, I had coached as a kid at Champneys Health Farms, and I'd met a chap who became a great friend called Dr. Nick Georgiadis. Georgiadis was a brilliant occupational psychologist. One of the best in the world. He's sadly no longer with us. Extraordinary teacher. And he said to me, why don't you come and work for me for a while? And I said, well, what do you do? And he told me, and he said, you know, you'd be very good at it. And I said, well, yeah, but I'm not a psychologist. He said, well, yeah, it just so happens that I've been studying it for many, many years, and you've just got the ability to be able to do this. Why don't you just come and work with me and let's see, that's how it goes. So I did. And I worked with Nick for 2 years, and goodness me, what a gift to be given. You know, you go to the programs, help create programs. He gives you lots of confidence in your ability to go and create things, have an imagination. How can you get through to people? I'm a good teacher. And so working with Nick, I learned all about occupational psychology. I learned lots of things about psychology and people. And then I was lucky enough to go and sit with one of his heroes, who was probably the godfather of occupational psychology, Warren Bennis. If ever anybody is going to read a book on leadership, you go to Warren Bennis. Even today, there are thousands of books on leadership, most of which you can pick out two or three things in the book that might be useful. But you go to Bennis and every page is lined with wonderful substance. Georgiadis loved Bennis. I could spend a bit of time with Bennis and learn lots of things from him. And then I worked a little while for a clinical psychologist, a woman called Dr. Gloria Lippman, and she was an authority on addiction. And so I got this rounded education in psychology without having to go into the classroom.
Gosh, that sounds perfect. And then when you go into companies, Toby, it is all about people for you, isn't it? And personalities.
Well, it is and it isn't. Stephen Covey very famously said, culture eats strategy for breakfast. We know what he was trying to do. He was trying to say, you know, culture's hugely important. As a businessman, I understand that actually culture isn't more important than strategy, because if you don't have a vision, you don't have a strategy, you can't start the culture. However, once you've got the strategy and once you've got the vision, then it all becomes around culture and leadership. But you have to link the strategy to the vision. The vision comes first, then the strategy. And then when you've got the strategy, how long is that strategy in place for, and what do we need to do with the culture in order to get that performance? And so that's what I go into. So I look at the strategy of the organization. I'm usually working alongside the CEO and then, of course, their leadership team. And I will review that leadership team and look at how they work, some of their behaviors in terms of the team, in terms of individuals. I look at succession planning and then look further and broader to their teams, where there's often huge amounts of talent that nobody's looking at. Or if they are looking at it, they're stopping them from becoming the talent that they should be, from reaching their potential, usually because people are scared. A leader should walk into a room with their team and go, I need to understand every single one of these people and understand their potential. Because if I understand their potential, sounds a bit crass, but it absolutely is right. If I understand their potential, just by me building and helping them reach that potential, I'm going to benefit.
And are there tips, Toby, that we can all take away? I mean, without you giving all your secrets away, but are there some basic things that you think perhaps companies here in Britain or anywhere in the world don't really do well that would be easy to fix?
Curiosity and a willingness to learn and not pretend that you know everything, and protect yourself. That would be my way. Let's talk about the Middle East, the growing economies. Let's talk about the United States. You talk about culture there, you talk about leadership with these guys. They're eating out of your hands for information. They want to learn. They're very curious. They want to be modern. They want to go invent. They want to reinvent. You know, the UK now, particularly with COVID, that's another thing, but we should be reinventing ourselves. It's a reinvention. But you can't reinvent with the behaviors and the notions that are coming from the past. And so I don't see huge amounts of that in this country, and certainly from leaders within it. And this equality area is very strange, I think, because we need to broaden our lens in leadership through which we probably develop a more humane human psychology.
I'm certainly with you there. Now, you got me to prompt you about Black Lives and Berlin. What was the story that sprang to mind?
Look at Bristol in the UK and tearing the statues down. And let's not go into whether that's right or wrong. But there are massive questions that we need to be asking. And I remember being in Berlin in 1990, 8 months after the wall had come down, and I'm working there with Germans. And of course, one of the things in Berlin was, what are we going to do with Hitler's bunker? Great question. Do we keep it or do we blow it up and pretend it was never there? Well, fortunately, at least to my mind, they decided to keep it. And I think it's a very good idea, because we need history as it was at that time, because it gives us great lessons. And so in terms of Black Lives Matter, but much more around equality, when I'm looking at leadership, I am taken back to my lessons from Georgiadis and Bennis and Dennis Beard, who gave me a great opportunity at Reading University that later enabled me to become a fellow over at Henley Management College. But I look at certain leaderships and leaders, and most of the time you go to black leaders. You can turn up in the Middle East and start talking about Winston Churchill. Well, it was a long time ago, and indeed he was an amazing leader. But actually, if you go to black leaders, black American leaders, let's talk about those for a little while. Wow, because they had to overcome. Still, a lot of it has not been overcome, but they had to overcome so much downtrodden ridiculousness that they were just treated like utter scum. So Martin Luther King, Muhammad Ali, Maya Angelou. I mean, Maya Angelou, what an extraordinary woman. You cannot get better than that in terms of leadership. And I don't know how many leadership programs mention Maya Angelou, But if you don't, you're missing out on something extraordinary for the people who you're teaching. Because not only is she a woman, but she did the most extraordinary things, including, by the way, admitting that she was a sex worker, but became this great poet and actually ended up at the inauguration of Clinton reading a poem.
And of course, that's what we all remember her for, isn't it?
And then, of course, in my own world of what was the tennis, you can't go anywhere else than Arthur Ashe. Incredible. Mandela, Gandhi. And then you have to go to King Hussein. And then if you're in the Middle East, and there are some incredible leaders out there, and they're very visionary.
You mentioned Muhammad Ali, and our listeners won't see this because obviously this is a podcast, not television, but there's a photograph of Muhammad Ali on your wall. And I'm going to get you to indulge me because I know that you were a friend of his and you knew him. So come on, what was he like?
As I look at my life and friends who I've been lucky enough to be able to call friends, in reflection, they really are the most wonderful, wonderful people. And I don't know how on earth I've gone from that little place in Wendover to being able to spend lots of time with these just giants of giant human beings, no less than Muhammad Ali. And that was a fluke. I was married at the time. I was 28 years old. I'd been married for a year of a three-year marriage. We were happily in New York City on Fifth Avenue. And I said, well, there's a big queue over there. What are they queuing for? And I'm always curious. I went across the road. I said, what are you queuing for? And somebody told me that Muhammad Ali was signing books at Barnes & Noble on Fifth Avenue. Well, this queue was five blocks long and I was going to join it. Hours later, I got to the front of the queue. There's Ali sitting there. And I'd worked out what I was going to say to him, and which was really something around, I just want to thank you for being who you are, because you've just helped me enormously, although I've never met you before. But just by getting up, watching you box and becoming interested in you, you've given me something that's enormous. And of course, you've done this for the whole world of anybody who's interested in Ali. Anyway, he asked me to sit down. Now, when I got to that front door of Barnes & Noble, there was about 20 blocks long, the queue, and everybody was shuffling around. Uh-huh. And anyway, I sat down. I felt as if I'd been there for 10 minutes. I'd probably sat with him for about 4 or 5 minutes, of which we had a really very meaningful conversation, for me, at least. It was an intimate conversation we had. I remember kissing him goodbye, and this giant of a man who, by the way, is very beautiful. And I say that because it's relevant. He's a boxer. He gets beaten up. I mean, walking out of Barnes & Noble, I think I walked for about 30 seconds and just burst into tears. Well, little did I know that that was the beginning of knowing Muhammad Ali.
How come?
About 5 years later, I was back in New York and I was with a friend and they said, you know, I've never been to this particular restaurant. Do you think we could go? And I said, of course, let's do that. And so we were sitting down and this person I'm sitting with said, is that Muhammad Ali? So I thought it must be a statue of Ali or something. I said, probably, yes. I didn't bother looking. So they said, no. Is that Muhammad Ali over there? And I turned around and of course, yes, it was. So I got up and I went and said, hello, and I'm sorry to disturb you and everything else. And he said, you know, is that your girl down there? And I said, yes, and had lunch. And from there on, we became great friends and I was lucky enough to see him on several occasions.
You said he had beautiful hands too, which is interesting, isn't it, for a boxer?
Huge hands, yes. Just everything was in proportion. Even those hands were fantastic.
Toby, I'd like to end, if I may, if it's not too personal, on just asking, you've become a father a little bit later in life. You've got a beautiful little five-year-old. How are you finding fatherhood?
Yes, I've got a little five-year-old. Well, she's still four, but she'll be five soon. It's the greatest thing that's ever happened in my life. And of course, that was all rather fluky. I got lucky again, I suppose.
We don't need too many details.
We won't give too many details there, no. Goodness me, what a little gem she is. And every moment I spend with her is terrific. I'm going to say this. When I wake up in the morning, I say to myself, it's important to get into good trouble. It's important to get into good trouble.
And what's good trouble?
Good trouble is change. Go and see how you can make things better. If you're not making things better, what's the point? if you're not doing the right things and challenging things that are difficult to do, but to make it better, why on earth are we here?
Well, I endeavour to get into as much good trouble as I can. Thank you so much for joining me today, Toby. I knew this was going to be a great pleasure, and please do keep us posted on all your projects, including the Coalition of Hope, which I hope is a massive, massive success because it's so needed.
Helen, thank you very much. It's been a wonderful pleasure and privilege to be talking with you. I didn't think I'd ever be doing that.
You've been listening to executive coach, motivational speaker, and lots of other things, Toby Foxcroft. I hope you've enjoyed his chat as much as I have. Download our series at convex.podbean.com or search The Convex Conversation on Spotify, Apple and Google Podcasts, or simply ask Alexa. I'll be back next week with another great guest, so bye for now.